Well, like I said, surprise. We're just going to jump in and do Proverbs, because after last week, where it seemed like there was still like enough interest in like doing like a full-blown adult forum over the summer, I was like, well, we do have a topic that I know folks are interested in, so yes. Let's do it. So like the basic background here, like the Book of Proverbs is in the Hebrew Scriptures, Old Testament, 31 chapters long. So actually growing up at the little Southern Baptist church that I went to, Brother Sid, the pastor, was a big advocate for, you can read a chapter of it a day and read it in a month. So like one of his personal devotional things was every morning he read a psalm and a chapter of Proverbs. This is, you know, part of his devotional life. And yeah, like you could certainly do worse for, you know, like patterns to get into there. Because again, it is very easy to remember what chapter you're on, you know. Obviously the name kind of gives away a little bit like what the book is full of there. But the first like 7 verses of it really lay out the whole purpose of the book there. The Proverbs of Solomon, King David's son from Israel. Their purpose is to teach wisdom and discipline, to help one understand wise sayings. They provide insightful instruction, which is righteous, just, and full of integrity. They make the naive mature, the young knowledgeable and discreet. The wise hear them and grow in wisdom. Those with understanding gain guidance. They help one understand proverbs and difficult sayings, the words of the wise and their puzzles. Wisdom begins with the fear of the Lord, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. So, I feel like there are sometimes when you sit down with the Bible and start at the beginning of a book of it, there's a little bit of a, well, I don't know what's going to be in here. Like, what kind of book is this going to be? Like, Proverbs, like, you don't make it through the first paragraph without a pretty clear understanding of what the point of it all is. So just like this is the like little bit of background kind of week here, and then we'll really, really get into it starting next week. But it's always good to start with the, you know, where does this come from? Who wrote it? What's the purpose kind of stuff? So like most books in the Old Testament, there is tradition around it, and there is also modern scholarship around it. Tradition very clearly connects it to Solomon. And so it has historically been linked to King Solomon, so David's son who succeeds him as king of Israel after David's death, and who will open up the Bible and take a look at sort of why Solomon is so closely linked to the wisdom tradition here. But it is one of the 3 books that is historically connected to him in the wisdom literature. It's this, the book that we call Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs, also known as the Song of Solomon, which all comprise what we call like the wisdom literature in the Old Testament, and they're each like really interesting because they're not, I feel like they're not what we're taught to expect in the Bible. Like Proverbs, it is the only place where we really find like a collection of like sayings, like wise sayings and ideas. Like it's a very much a style of book and literature that was super common in the ancient Near East. So like you can find similar kind of collections to the Book of Proverbs in like Babylonian literature and in ancient Greek and other, all these like different like civilizations around Israel. Like this was a really common kind of book, but it's not really like anything else in the Bible, which is probably why we don't see it show up a whole lot in the lectionary church, because out of 31 chapters, like 20 of them are sort of like 1 or 2 verse kind of standalone, like Proverbs, like very individual sayings and stuff that are just kind of put together in these collections.
Could you please go back to the other 2 wisdom literature?
Yeah.
Okay, what are
So Ecclesiastes and the book, like either Song of Songs or Song of Solomon. It's, let's say that one, it's an interesting case of like the two names. Like in Hebrew, it is the Song of Songs, Hashir Hashirim. Because it is connected with Solomon, a lot of times people will call it the Song of Solomon. But it kind of switch hits in terms of names. And a lot of times, like in you know, publications of Bibles, you'll see it titled one and the other, like in parentheses with it. So it's known as by both. So Proverbs is like very much, like I said, this kind of collection of wise sayings anthology. Ecclesiastes is a very different kind of wisdom literature where it's like longer reflections on stuff. And it's very, like people have attributed it to being like, if Proverbs is Solomon and kind of his like glory days of the wise ruler and judge of the people giving out wisdom, Ecclesiastes is the wisdom of the aging monarch who is looking at decades of life and has come away a little cynical from all of it. And then the Song of Solomon is erotic love poetry, which is absolutely not something you expect to find in the Bible, but there it is. And it's like, if you think people struggle with what to do with Proverbs, they really struggle to know what to do with like the Song of Solomon, because it's a bunch of kind of steamy love poetry in the middle of the Old Testament. And so there have been lots of attempts at saying like, well, it's an analogy for God's love for the chosen people or Christ's love for the church and stuff. And at some point there may be a, we'll do a look into it just because it's fascinating. Like I personally think like it's actually just a sign that God actually approves of love and intimacy between, you know, like married partners and stuff there, but that's the conversation for another time. Other than to say that as you know middle schoolers at Brazosport Christian School in Bible class, we apparently our way of misbehaving was to look up like passages from it and like whisper shout like chapter 7 verses 7 and 8 at each other across the room. So people would like look them up and be like,
well, I'm frankly looking at it right now. That's right. You know that name.
But
so was this kind of stuff written for like common people, the people who weren't educated, who couldn't read, you know, that kind of thing?
Right. So it's an interesting case in that because, so if you could actually read it, you automatically were not part of the common people at this time period because you were educated enough to be able to read.
Yeah.
That being said, kind of like pre-literate societies like this were like only like a small percentage of people had that level of education.
Right.
Usually had very strong like oral traditions and like there would be people who are like the designated readers. Like if you were to go to the synagogue or the temple, somebody who did know how to read would be like the person in charge of reading the lessons, and they would read them for the people so that everybody had access to it. So I think there is a certain sense in which, given the amount of counsel that there is about what to do with like money and wealth and stuff that shows up in here, I'd say Solomon's audience probably was at least like not the peasants, but it certainly is like aimed, I would say, at a pretty general audience. Not just, you know, kings and rulers and stuff. Though there are a couple of passages in there that are very specifically described like what a wise ruler should be like and things like that too. So it's just actually one of the things that I enjoy about the Proverbs is that it really is there's something for everybody. Because regardless of who you are, where you come from, you know, your gender, your socioeconomic status, whatever, there's stuff in here that, like, can speak very directly to you and your life and how you live. So the way that the book is kind of divided up, with it's like I heard it described as like an anthology of anthologies, where, you know, it's a collection of collections that you can split into six or so different parts. And most of it is devoted to, again, like these very direct kind of one-off wise sayings that cover a pretty broad swath of, you know, moral and ethical and life kind of situations. The way that the book starts, though, is the first few chapters of it are very much devoted really to the question of what is wisdom and why is it worth seeking out? You know, it's like if you're going to gain wisdom from these proverbs, it's a little bit of the like, well, so what does it mean to be wise? Like, what does a wise person look like? What do they live like? What, where does wisdom come from? So like that's kind of the introductory part of it. There are a few, with that too, a few chapters that are more in-depth looks at particular topics. Like there's a whole chapter here, it's chapter 5 maybe, that is really actually just devoted to the subject basically of marital fidelity and adultery, which was a huge issue like in like the morality of ancient Israel, which is a place where there are, you know, where polygamy is practiced and marriages very often tended to be arranged. So that theme of, you know, faithfulness becomes really important because there's, you know, if we're talking a society that isn't monogamous love matches like what we're used to for, you know, being the baseline for marriage, it becomes a very different proposition because, like, if you've got three wives and all three of them were arranged marriages, you know, it's a lot easier to, you know, picture people going like, oh, well, I'm going to have, like, my mistress over here that, like, I'm actually, like, attracted to and, you know, have a thing with. And then there are my wives. And so, like, a big focus, like, is, like, no, that's not how society operates. It's not how we do things.
Well, and that is why this is a good thing. We're probably not doing that as a church service.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, would, by the way, so right. Perfect for adults.
No, exactly. Like, number one, like, there are some things in here where it's, like, yeah, this will be fun to explain to your children later, you know, when you get home here,
yeah.
Number one. And then number two, it's, I like the chat, my preaching professor in seminary, Dr. Satterley, was a big, like, emphasized, like, the point of preaching is to proclaim the gospel. That's what it's defined as. That's the point of it. Like, Bible study is Bible study. Preaching is preaching. Like, don't, you know, they can inform each other, but don't just turn your sermon into a glorified Bible study. Well, so finding the good news sometimes in Proverbs, like, requires a little more digging, because again, like, if it's a chapter of, you know, here's 20 verses on why we don't commit adultery, like, that's, number one, like, it's a little bit of a, like, this kind of speaks for itself. And then number two also is, like, it's a little harder to tie that into, like, the good news of, you know, like, we are saved by grace through faith for Christ's sake apart from works. That being said, I had a professor when I was in college who was a great professor. She was our church history expert and just brilliant, like, Dr. Schneider forgot more about, like, church history than 99% of, like, Christians probably ever know. Just brilliant mind, great teacher, really supportive, like, faculty member. Like, she was, you know, like, just on a personal level. I remember once she made a comment, we were in a class that I had, about how Proverbs was one of her least favorite parts of the Bible because it just felt like a big list of what rich people should do with their money. And I'm not saying that there aren't parts of it that feel like advice on how people should manage their money, because there is plenty of that in there. But, like, having, again, grown up in the world of, like, well, read a chapter of Proverbs a day, kind of, like, background. It was like, I was very familiar with it. I was like, but there's so much else in there. Like, there is so much good stuff in there. And I think things that do point toward, like, how wise living actually looks, like, taking, like, grace and mercy and fleshing it out in terms of, like, how we live our lives, how we treat the people around us, how we make good use of, like, the gifts that and blessings that God provides for us and stuff. I mean, and yes, it also Kibbs provided a few passages that don't feel strikingly relevant to everybody, or worse, in the case of a couple that we'll talk about where, you know, it is, let's just say, very reflective of a 3,000-year-old understanding of what a woman's place is supposed to be that clashes a little bit with where we're at in 2026. But again, like, I'm not a throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of person with that. It was like, my attitude has always been like, nope, this is the scripture we have. So let's wrangle with it a little bit and, like, let's find the good and figure out what to do with the stuff that challenges us or confronts us with, like, parts of the human experience that we look at and go, like, maybe that didn't age so well. Whether it's on, you know, gender, whether it is on the very much legal and approved, you know, slavery that existed in the Old Testament, and so on and so forth.
But there's slavery that's existing now.
Well, and there is.
And there's lots of places on the planet where they're still living back in the Dark Ages, as in Islam. They believe, you know, they believe in stoning women who commit adultery. I mean...
You're right. Like, there are absolutely places where this isn't... It does not feel like there is 3,000 years of societal change and development between this and that. It's more like, nope, we're still right there.
Yeah, they're still there.
And so, and I think there's a lot of... I think part of the value for us in contending with those things that seem to, like, you know, that we find in scripture that are like, yes, this is how, you know, this is how it is that it gives us the chance to reflect on, like, okay, so what's the good news we can offer the world to people who still experience this as, you know, everyday life? It's like, it doesn't have to be that way. Like, we believe in a God who does not think that people should be stoned to death for adultery, and incidentally, it's always women who get stoned to death for adultery instead of the men.
Right, instead of men, and that takes two.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. As we see in Song of Songs, but all right. So one of the challenges that does show up in dealing with something that is a collection of collected works is that you do run into a few moments where the wisdom offered up in Proverbs seems like it, maybe doesn't always agree. And there's actually a perfect example of it. If somebody wants to grab a pew Bible and find Proverbs chapter 26, verses 4 through 5, like, these literally, like, verses that are immediately next to each other, like, it illustrates the occasional challenge that comes up here, like, perfectly. I say, if somebody who's found it wants to read it out loud, go ahead.
Okay, you're talking about 26:5.
26 verses 4 and 5.
Perfect. Do not answer fools according to their folly, or you will be a fool yourself. And answer fools according to their folly, or they will be wise in their own eyes.
So, like, literally verses next to each other, one of them says, don't answer fools according to their folly, because it is the fancy biblical way of saying my dad's favorite saying of don't argue with an idiot, because they'll just drag you down to their level and then beat you with experience. Which is the number one rule of life on the internet. It's like, just don't go in the comment section. Just don't argue.
You can't fix stupid, I know.
Yep. And then, like, the next verse, it's like, you should answer a fool according to their folly so they have a chance to learn. And there's a little bit of it like, well...
But will they?
And number one is like, well, which is it? Like, don't do it or do it.
Right. Jackie, what you said reminds me of that shirt my pen pal got.
Oh, it can't fix the duct tape.
Oh. It says duct tape. It won't fix stupid, but it will muffle the sound.
I have one that says, wine is to women like duct tape is to men.
But the wisdom comes in all sources.
Yes.
I say, like, actually, like, I feel like Proverbs is, like, the perfect book of the Bible for people who love, like, pithy, funny, like, t-shirts and bumper stickers, because it's the same kind of vibe of, like, let's condense, like, this into, like, one, like, easy little saying here, like, which is a fine art to doing, like, to, like, condense it, a big idea down into something that's, like, quick and witty and that people can remember. But so, it is unlikely that there are a few sections in the book that, like, are attributed to people other than Solomon anyways. So, the idea that, like, King Solomon personally wrote everything in the book of Proverbs, like, not even the book of Proverbs, supports that. There's some question of, like, clearly it is linked to Solomon, so undoubtedly some, if not much, of the content of it probably does find its roots in his sayings, his wisdom and, you know, dictums and stuff as, you know, a leader. It's also possible that the idea of, like, a proverb of Solomon is a little bit of a description of a style. You know, it is a proverb in the style of Solomon. Because if you notice, like, as you read this, like, the proverbs, like, there's a little bit of a pattern to how a lot of the verses play out. So some people have suggested, like, it's kind of like the idea of a Psalm of David. Like, yeah, David probably wrote plenty of these, but it also is descriptive of a particular style of writing as well, because you can usually tell what the Davidic Psalms are, because similarly, they've kind of got a particular pattern that they'll follow and stuff.
This reminds me of, college literature. Taking Shakespeare or something like that, or the Iliad, or
right.
trying to understand what is meant by mm-hmm. the passages.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, exactly. Like, for me, like, part of, like, faithfully studying the Bible is, like, a little bit of doing your homework on the, like, where did this come from? What is it rooted in? What can help us understand it best the way that it would have been understood by its original intended audience, so we can get the most out of it. Well, so linking it, though, to Solomon, like, regardless of what percentage of it he personally is responsible for, which we're never going to know that, but, like, clearly it's rooted in that tradition, and we won't take the time to read all of, like, chapter 3 of, like, 1 Kings, but are we all familiar with kind of the story of, like, Solomon's wisdom? So, I'll give the Reader's Digest version. Solomon, when he first becomes king, prays, praying for how he might be a good ruler. And he prays that he might have wisdom to be a good king. Like, he doesn't pray for wealth, he doesn't pray for power, he doesn't pray that his enemies be defeated. He prays for wisdom. So God speaks to him in a dream and says, because your prayer was that you be wise, not only am I going to answer that and give you great wisdom, you also are going to be, you know, wealthy and powerful and have peace in your time from your enemies, because you chose so well in terms of what you asked me for as a king. So when we read the description of, like, Solomon's reign in Israel, it is the absolute high watermark for the Israelite kingdom. It is a time of peace and prosperity, which is an incredible change after the days of Saul and David, where there is constant conflict and turmoil and the like. Like, David is a man after God's own heart, but David was also a warrior who spent a lot of time fighting the Philistines, engaged in a civil war against King Saul, and then having to fight multiple uprisings and insurrections by his own children against him. Like, man after God's own heart, but David left a little bit to be desired as a father with some of his stuff. And so Solomon, meanwhile, it's like, all this is settled. The kingdom is at peace. They're in the middle of all of the important trade routes going through the Eastern Mediterranean, so there is tons of wealth. People are living like high on the hog. And Solomon is viewed so positively by like the neighbors that like Israel, for really the only time in its history, like in the ancient era, becomes like not like a world power, but at least like a major regional player, instead of being, you know, the backwater that gets kicked around by the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the like. It's the golden age. And because of that, it's a time period where Solomon is the one who is able to build the temple in Jerusalem. Because there is peace and prosperity, so there is the time and the resources to spend on building this magnificent temple. So after Solomon's like prayer and dream, it gives us an example of Solomon's wisdom, which this is the story that I think a lot of people think of when it's Solomon, where he's holding court and two women come in with a dispute over a baby, where they like say, like, you know, we both are prostitutes, we live together, we both had babies at a roughly the same time. And it's the argument back and forth over, like, one of them, you know, accidentally rolled over and smothered her baby, like, as they slept. And so one of the women says, like, it was this one and she stole my baby and is pretending it's hers and put the dead one in my bed. And the other one's like, no, that's not how it happened. And they go back and forth. So Solomon is like, all right, well, the fair thing to do then is, like, we'll just, you know, have my swordsman over here, like, cut the baby in half, and you get half, and you get half. And then the one who is the actual mother is like, fine, just let her have the baby then. Just don't hurt the baby. And Solomon's like, that's the real mom. Because she's the one who does not want to see the baby hurt. Because, like a good mother, she wouldn't want to see her. She'd rather see somebody else raise her baby than have it be killed. And all the people marveled at his wisdom. And so, like, you even have, like, the stories, too, about the Queen of Sheba coming from afar with, you know, gifts to come and meet with Solomon and, like, hear his great wisdom and things like that. So we grounded in that tradition because Solomon is, like, the face of wisdom, like, in the Hebrew scriptures. So it was like, you want to be wise? Like, listen to this guy. Like, he's literally wrote the book on it.
So as far as when these people lived, did he live about the same time as Moses, or?
So Solomon would have been, at this point, several hundred years after the Exodus. So, because we've got ish about 1,000 years probably between like Moses and the birth of Jesus. So like Solomon would have fallen like before the midway mark in there, closer to Moses than to Jesus, but still centuries, not decades after Moses. So because after, you know, like they leave Egypt, 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, Moses dies, Joshua takes over, they come into the promised land, and then there's sort of a century to two century period of turmoil and comparative anarchy where there's not really like a centralized like government or a king or anything. And then the monarchy starts up after that, and Solomon is the third of the kings of Israel. There's a few hundred years of the monarchy. The Babylonians come in and take over. there's 70 years of exile. They come back after the Persians have taken over stuff. And then between that era and Jesus is 600 to 700 years. Probably like 6, because it's about 700 years from like Isaiah to Jesus, and Isaiah was a generation or two before the Babylonians like sacked everything.
So is there a place where there is a timeline, or you know, something you could look at and say, okay,
this yeah, is you know, and I can, I'll bring one next time. Like I'll print something off.
I have the book.
Mm-hmm.
That has the timeline, that shows the timeline from the whole.
Right.
Cool.
And a lot of times too, like if you've got a study Bible and stuff, like the a lot of times if you look in kind of the appendices and stuff, like that's, you'll find stuff like that there. Solomon, we're still talking like for us closer to 3,000 years ago than 2,000 years ago, like probably 2700, 2800.
How did their year compare to what we have as a year now?
So, like, the timekeeping in kind of like in Judaism, it actually does get interesting because they use a lunar calendar, not a solar calendar. So, like, and similar to like, not the only peoples that did this, like the Mayans use a lunar calendar. Actually, like, the Arab calendar also is lunar, which is why, like, the Ramadan. Like the month in which like Muslims fast like during the day for a month isn't like the same time every year, it moves. So the Jewish lunar calendar, which because like again, like if you follow the lunar cycle, that's exactly 4 weeks for a month, 28 days, because the moon is extremely regular with that. Like the sun is a little, you know, it was a little less obvious for measuring in like ancient times. But because of that, you do end up getting discrepancies in terms of numbers of years and when dates line up and stuff. Now, the Jewish calendar, they basically, and I do not understand how it works, so I can't explain it, but I do know that they built in kind of a system to more or less like balance things out to keep the same months in the same general season of the year, which is why Passover always occurs more or less around the same time as like Easter. Like there'll sometimes be like up to like a, you know, like multiple week difference between them, but they're still like in the spring. Whereas like Ramadan, I remember like when I was a kid growing up and, you know, watching the Houston Rockets and everybody prayed that Hakeem Olajuwon would not be fasting during the day during the playoffs. I remember like it always lined up like then with late spring, early summer, and now it, you know, like Ramadan was early to mid spring this year, and it's been in the middle of the summer and stuff because like their calendar just follows the moon. They don't have them built in like kind of a equilibration system.
So we have right. One more day every 4 years.
Yep, exactly.
So, I mean,
yeah. Yep. Yeah, like we do the same thing with the solar calendar because a day isn't 24 hours. It's 23 hours and 57 minutes. And so you got to make those 3 minutes up eventually. So every 4 years, it equals another day. But so with that, then, like, it does create the challenge of the how do we date stuff and keep track of years and stuff in the Old Testament. And like the dates and stuff in Genesis are just its own special brand of, you know, Methuselah is 900 some years old. You know, like the like reckoning with like, okay, are we talking solar years? Are we talking lunar years? Did they measure a year the same way? Is this just basically their way of saying like the dude was really old? Again, like there's debates about the timekeeping with that. Now, by the time we get to kind of what we call like a little more like the historical era, where like starting in like Moses and Exodus and stuff, by then we've kind of got enough of a sense of like standardized timekeeping to where, like, with some help from archaeology and historical records and stuff, we can more or less date things at least to kind of like a generation's worth of time. It's like, I can't tell you that, like, King David, you know, was born on January 16th, you know, year such and such. But I can tell you, like, he was born probably around the year such and such. You know, give or take a little.
Just like Jesus wasn't really born on December 25th.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah, bingo. Like, yeah. Jesus wasn't born on December 25th, and he probably wasn't born exactly at the beginning of the year 1 AD either. Like, because, again, like, that year was picked based off of, you know, some calendar decisions by people who didn't do very good math, and it's actually probably more likely that, like, the birth of Jesus was, like, a few years prior to that, but, again, like, doesn't really matter. Like, not inherently, but at least we can, like, get a general sense of, like, this is the time period.
I know this is not about Proverbs, but how do we know Jesus wasn't born then? I mean, you know,
because the scientists have determined that Jesus wasn't born on that day. They celebrated that day because the people were celebrating a certain equinox or something or other like that on that day, and so they set the day for Jesus to be born on that day because that was when all the rest of the people were celebrating this other
yep.
significant day.
That's one part of the answer. There's another part to it too in terms of evidence to suggest why it wouldn't have been then. So the shepherds were out with their flocks by night. Late December is still winter in, you know, like, the eastern Mediterranean. While it's not Wisconsin, it's still cold and crummy weather. You wouldn't have been out in the fields with your flocks. That's a, like, spring, summer, fall type thing. Winter, the animals would have been, like, in their pens, like, being fed hay and stuff. So the time periods is more likely would have been spring and fall for, like, when shepherds would have been out in the fields. And likewise,
the baby would not have existed in freezing temperatures.
Right. You know, like, being born in a barn in the middle of winter.
Right.
And also, like, people wouldn't have been traveling because it's, you know, we're talking, you know, the main Roman roads were very well paved and maintained and stuff, but anything other than kind of the Roman, like, superhighway type construction there, I mean, this is the one time of the year where it does tend to rain, like, significantly in the Middle East. So the roads are going to be a mud pit, so.
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I thought, how did that work? But I always thought it was just magical or something. Right. It was the Bible. It was.
No, it was probably just September, not December.
Right.
And in terms of the, like, why December, it's like, yeah, like, the winter solstice is December 21st-ish every year. And so the Romans had kind of solstice celebrations, like Saturnalia going on then. Followers of the Persian sun god, like Mithra, had, like, their big feast of what's called the Sol Invictus, like the unconquerable sun, the unconquerable light. As, you know, like this, again, like in Persian legends, kind of savior figure is born in, you know, to bring light in the midst of darkness. Sounds like the beginning of John's gospel a little bit. So early Christians were like, why don't we celebrate Jesus' birth here? Because, one, people, like, during periods of persecution, folks were like, oh, they're just celebrating Saturnalia or Sol Invictus or something else, so you could blend in a little bit. And two, like, the symbolism of, you know, the light of the world being born in the darkest time of the year, I think is really powerful for those of us who, you know, live in a world with seasons.
Plus, it wasn't really written when it was happening.
Right.
It was written hundreds of years later.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so, yeah, like, by the time, like, Christians are celebrating Christmas, like, we're talking, yeah, like,
hundreds of years.
A significant amount of time has passed, right. So it's not like anybody in living memory has a date written down anyways. And the gospel writers, like, within the first few generations of stuff, that didn't think that was an important enough detail to write down. I mean, Mark doesn't even have, like, a birth narrative for Jesus, so later generations decided it was worth celebrating and kind of picked a time that worked on a few different levels instead of a, like, oh, well, we know he was, you know, like, Jesus' birth certificate says he was born at, you know, 12:15 a.m. on December 25th, like, 81, which would be nice if anything ever operated with that degree of certainty in studying the Bible, but sadly, those kind of moments are few and far between with things that are 2,000 years old.
But even the manger, could they not have found a barn? Or, you know,
right.
We see the manger in our vision of this thing that's old.
Right.
But they didn't have mangers back then. Didn't they live in caves and things?
I was
like saying,
like, some of it, yeah, it's like we're probably, yeah, talking like built into a cave, like, you know, like animal food trough, like potentially even like just like hollowed out stone, like.
Right.
Well, I'm having this inspiration, whatever, right now. It's like, oh.
I mean, part of the joy of it is that, like, for me, is that we can dig in and, like, archaeology and history and other, like, existing literature from the time period can give us so much to work with and trying to come up with ideas about what it was like. But at the end of the day, they can give us ideas, but they don't tell us, like, it was exactly like this. You know, here is, you know, the blueprint for what the inn and, you know, the, you know, barn/animal area and manger all look like. Here were its exact dimensions. We're given the freedom to be able to use, like, kind of we can use the left side of our brain for gathering a lot of the information about what it would might have been like. And we still get the, you know, creative license to let the Holy Spirit lead our imaginations a little bit too and picture what was it like.
And even what Jesus looked like.
Yep. Because, yeah, again, like, we are well before the age of photography here, you know, by 1900 years. So, yeah, it's like.
Well, it would have been Caucasian. No.
Nope. No. I say a Middle Eastern Jewish man. Yeah.
We're
probably not talking, like, you know, lily white, blonde hair, blue eyed, you know, Norwegian mm-hmm. Jesus that, you know, we see sometimes in, like, artwork and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, which actually is, like, one of the things that I have enjoyed is it's always you can tell a lot about who founded the church by the art that's on display. Because you go into, you know, like, I think about, like, you know, like, little country Lutheran church in Iowa in a community where everybody's last name ends in Sunberg or Quist. like where I lived for a year in Dayton, where, like, you know, like, the only people who weren't Swedish were, like, me and Ted Semprini. And he had lived there for so long, people just called him Ted Semprini-son. He's like, well, he's Italian, but he married a Swede. But so, like, unsurprisingly, like, the, you know, like, 100-year-old, like, painting, like, behind the altar there, it's like, Jesus looks very Northern European. You go to St. Benedict the African, like, Catholic parish of, like, 63rd and Cottage Grove, or, no, it's farther west than that. I forget exactly the cross streets, but,
Western?
Like, south, maybe, yeah.
Western.
So, but, like, south side of Chicago, and, you know, like, you see depictions of, I mean, obviously, like, St. Benedict the African, like, the patron saint there for the church who was African, hence the name. But, like, exactly. And you see, like, depictions of, like, Jesus where, like, Jesus looks African. It was, like, our human culture and background and stuff very often. It's, like, you know, what if God was one of us? Well, where we come from and what looks normal to us is often, like, how we choose to depict the God that we can see, Jesus. Though it, one thing that I do remember, so like late 90s, early 2000s, like high school for me, right before I started college, there was somebody who sort of used computer technology to imagine what Jesus like would have looked like based on like archaeological evidence and stuff for like what average height, etc., for like somebody from like that part of, you know, the world 2000 years ago would have looked like. And, you know, Jesus is pretty swarthy looking, you know, like olive skin, dark hair, shaggy beard, and larger nose. And some people had a fit because Jesus didn't look like the Albrecht Dürer, like, you know, print of like praying Jesus with the hands up like this that hung in their church growing up. And like, they couldn't believe that Jesus looked like that. And I was like, but it did. Yeah, exactly. It's like, to say, well, Jesus wasn't from 16th century Germany. So like, you know, he looked like a first century Middle Eastern Jewish man because he was.
All right. And that you also see Mary portrayed with blonde hair, the blue thing,
and blue eyes.
Exactly. And same deal where it's like, that is, the variety of depictions of Mary, too, based off of, you know, supposed apparitions of the Virgin around the world also just fascinate me to no end. Like, my all-time favorite being one in Argentina that is the, like, our gaucho lady of the mate, where, like, Mary supposedly appeared, like, out in the fields with, like, a bunch of cowboys, like, dressed up like a gaucho. Like, they were, like, serving the mate to drink. It was, like, only in Argentina. It was like, this is as local a like image of like what the Virgin would have looked like showing up as it gets.
I've seen programs on TV that fascinated me, especially the one where they did a reconstruction of the face of Cleopatra. Mm. And she looks totally different from what we think she looked like in the movies, because we've all seen the movies. And they did an actual reconstruction of what they really think she looked like.
Right.
And she had a hook nose and a protruding chin. Mm-hmm. And totally, totally not beautiful.
I would say not Elizabeth Taylor, no.
But she was supposedly brilliant. Mm-hmm. And spoke multiple languages and everything else like that, because she was like super educated.
Right, yeah.
But she was not pretty.
Yep.
But she was supposedly a seductress.
Right. And again, it was like the attraction there was definitely the power and the wealth and not...
And the brains.
Exactly.
Yeah, not what she did.
Not the physical appearance.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah, she was not pretty.
But this whole discussion is all about diversity and how, in my opinion, it's okay that we all have a different vision. And who's saying that this one is better than that one? And as you travel around,
I can say for myself, like, my understanding of who God is, who Jesus is, what it means to be a Christian, what it means to be faithful, what it means to bring it into a landing here, because I do need to get home so Colleen can take Eileen to Girl Scout camp.
I'm just going to is,
like, what it means to, like, be all this stuff is, like, other people's perspectives have helped me so much in expanding my own understanding and learning to where, like, I love it. Because, like, everybody, you know, I mean, again, like, even in a room full of people where, like, we, you know, live in the same context, like, we live in the same place, we're all from, you know, similar enough backgrounds in terms of, like, language, culture, ethnicity, and the like. But still have such a range of, like, life experiences and stuff. Like, even within that, like, think about all the different perspectives we get here. Now, when you start adding in, like, voices from all kinds of different experiences and stuff from around the world, like in kind of the global church, from across time and space and history. It's like, it's really powerful, I think, to get all of that collected wisdom that God gives us.
For next week, we should have read how much of Proverbs and...
So next week, we're going to probably focus mostly on the second half of chapter 1. So like at kind of verses 8 through the end of the chapter. Because we're going to talk about, like, that really gets into, starts getting into the question of what is wisdom.
Okay.
And so, like, that's what we're going to talk about next week. And sort of be like, okay, so this book is about wisdom. Well, what is that? What is it? What does Proverbs say that wisdom is? So it'll touch a little bit, some in chapter 1, and then a little bit in chapter 3 as well. Chapter 3.
Okay.
The first, like, 6 verses or so. Probably the most well-known verses in the whole book of Proverbs are, I think it's chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. So it's, you know, like my son, trust not on your own wisdom and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge God, and God will make your path straight.